In verse 6, we talked this morning, if you were here this morning, about the fact that Jesus left heaven and came to earth. In verse 6, it says, Christ, who being in the very form of God, did not consider that equality with God something to be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking on the form of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, became obedient to death, even death on a cross. So far this month, we've looked at every part of that except for the last verse. I just want to take a few moments tonight to meditate, think through the truth of this verse 8. He was by nature human. We looked at that, we established that this morning. It was not a Halloween costume, it was not theatrical, it was not just the appearance. Even though this text emphasizes again and again the appearance, he was in the form of a human, he was in the form of a servant, he was in the appearance of a man, the likeness of a man, it emphasized the external appearance. And we said, somebody might say, you know, wow, that sounds like it implies that he wasn't genuinely human. But we found this morning that he indeed was, there's no question about that. So why is it emphasized that he looked human? That on the outside, externally, he appeared that way. The reason the appearance is emphasized is because when you are in heaven and you look like God, you receive glory and praise and everything that you deserve. But when you are on earth and you look like a slave, you receive ill treatment and you become spit upon and beaten and mistreated and marginalized and ultimately killed. And that's the emphasis. The emphasis on appearance is to show it from our perspective, and there's a reason for that. From our perspective, he appeared human, and he was human, and there's a reason why that's true. It's one thing to condescend. It's another thing to condescend without anybody knowing it. That's hard. Jesus became human, so human, that everyone around saw him as only human. Sometimes we're willing to humble ourselves, but even then, when we are willing to do that, we tend to want everybody to know just how much we've humbled ourselves, just how far down we've come to meet them, right? That was mine, but you can have it. You know, we're willing to give just as long as everyone knows that we are giving, right? You know, you can imagine the secretary coming up to you and asking you, can you go and get a mop and clean up this mess? And you say, excuse me, but I don't know if you know, but I'm the chairman of the board of this corporation you work for. But, you know, I'll do it. See, well, sometimes we're willing to serve, but we want to make sure everyone knows just how much we're lowering ourselves. Jesus could have been born with a halo. He could have gone around with an entourage of angels everywhere, so that everyone knew. But he lowered himself so low that he became absolutely indistinguishable from other human beings. And almost all his life, everyone thought he was just another nobody. Incredible. In fact, he appeared so human, so ordinary, that they couldn't accept his teaching. His teaching was so profound. When he taught, they had the feeling that they were listening to the mind of God himself, but then they would shake that feeling off because they'd take another look at him and say, nah, he's just a plain human being. In Matthew 13, it says, coming to his hometown, he began teaching the people in their synagogue, and they were amazed. Where did this man get this wisdom and these miraculous powers? But then they'd say, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother named Mary? And aren't his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? And aren't all his sisters here with us? And where did this man get all these things? And they took offense at him. They couldn't figure it out, but they said, one thing, he's just a plain human being, that's for sure, because he's got all the earmarks of a normal human being. So when he finally did reveal to them who he really was, he performed astonishing miracles and just let loose his divine power. They said, this man has a demon. So God became a man, took on human flesh, and that's the incarnation. That's what we celebrate at Christmas. And the symbol that we generally use to show symbolize the meaning of all that is the symbol that we had up here on the stage this morning. The nativity scene, a little manger, a little lamb sitting there, maybe a cow or two. And, you know, we set up the little nativity scene, and that symbolizes this whole humiliation. Because you came down from the highest heaven all the way down to the lowest, most humble state. A little helpless baby laying in a manger. But you know, that's not quite the lowest point. If you think that's the extreme contrast from the glories of heaven down to a feed trough, being a helpless baby 100% dependent on a couple of teenagers for his survival, that's a pretty far way down. But he didn't even stop there. He didn't even stop there. He went even farther down from that. If we really want to symbolize the meaning of the incarnation, we shouldn't take it at its midpoint. We should just take it where it all the way, where it gets down to the end of verse 8. Look at verse 8. And being found in appearance as a man, even that wasn't enough. Even an appearance of a slave wasn't enough. Even appearance of being the lowliest of all men still wasn't enough. Here's what he did. Being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient. Now, obedience is a word that offends most people when it's applied to them. It's a virtue in Scripture, but it's not a virtue that most of us strive very much for. If people at work are talking about you and you're not there and you found out that they didn't think you could overhear, but they were saying, oh yeah, she's something else. She's such a hard worker. Yeah, that'd probably make you feel good. Or if they said, he's so smart, you know, he's just amazing. You know, you'd like that. But if you overheard them and they were saying, yeah, one thing about that guy, oh, is he ever obedient? You might not take that as much of a compliment, really. You might wonder what that means. We don't really seek to be that way very much. Most people wouldn't really be thrilled to be. In fact, they'd probably be embarrassed about that. To be a slave and to be obedient is a state of humiliation and humility. But even that wasn't far enough. Even to be known as one who is obedient wasn't far enough. He went farther down from there. He says he became obedient to death. Now you would have thought at some point he would have stopped. He would have said, this is enough. Stop. This is enough. I'm the Son of God. I demand that you recognize who I am. He wouldn't stop. He just kept going down and kept going down and kept going down. Inevitably, when you're dealing with somebody that's been offended and they're upset, they want the whole world to know they're offended, and they're mad, no matter how much you try and teach them the principles of verses 3 and 4, to consider others more important than yourselves and to defer to others and all that we talked about, it generally has no effect, because what they'll say is, you know what, I understand all that. I understand those principles about being humble and giving and all that stuff, but this is an exceptional case because I have really, really been offended. You know, this person just went too far. And humbling myself at this point would just be too much. How far did Jesus take it? To death. How far will humility go? As far as it's required to meet a need. That's all. Ask yourself this question. Next time you think it's just going to be too much to give in a situation, you ask yourself, if I humble myself in this situation, will it kill me? Literally, will I die? And if the answer is yes, perhaps you should still do it. Because just because it's going to cost you your life doesn't necessarily mean that's too high a price. That's what we see from Jesus. This is where you separate people who understand humility from the people that are faking it. This is where you understand separate the committed from the involved. You know, it's one thing to be involved, it's another thing to be committed. Right? I mean, the kamikaze pilot that flew 50 missions, he was involved, but not committed, right? There's a difference. And what Jesus calls us to is full-blown commitment, nothing short of that. What is your most prized possession? Is there a limit to what you would give up for God? It's interesting to me that this was an act of obedience for Christ. Dying, an act of obedience. You know, for all the rest of us, dying is not an act of obedience. It's inevitable. I mean, we have to do it whether we are willing to or not. Right? Appointed to man wants to die. But for Christ, it was a matter of obedience. He didn't have to die. No one could take his life from him. He could only give it up on his own. Only a divine being could death be a matter of obedience. And it was obedience to the Father. The Father required it of him. And everything about it was voluntary. In John 10:17, Jesus said, "The reason my Father loves me is that I lay down my life, only to take it up again. No one takes it from me. I lay it down on my own accord, and I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father." God commanded Jesus to die on the cross. And that's the next step down. It wasn't just death. He said he became obedient even to death, even death on a cross. Not just any death. The most painful, most humiliating form of execution that the Romans could think of. When Paul was writing this, penning these words, he knew very well that there was a chance that someday he would be executed by Rome. In fact, Paul was executed by Rome. But Paul had no fear whatsoever that he would ever be crucified. That wouldn't happen to Paul. There's no way that would happen to Paul, because Paul was a Roman citizen. He had certain rights, and they don't treat normal human beings like that. Even the Romans don't. The Romans would not just execute, just because someone was a criminal, execute him by means of crucifixion. Because it was so demeaning, so humiliating, and so painful that it was the Romans reserved that form of execution for only people that were considered non-human. Slaves. Basically, it was a way to execute slaves because they were not considered human beings. Jesus submitted himself not only to death, but to death on the cross. Did you know that this form of death is so horrible that in polite company, the Romans wouldn't even say the word cross because it was considered a... wasn't even the worst part. The shame was also horrible. The shame involved utter humiliation, hanging completely naked in front of a merciless, jeering crowd. The staggering incongruity of the King of Kings being subjected to that. And Hebrews 12:2 says that Jesus endured the cross for the joy set before him, but it also says he despised its shame. The shame was horrible. The worst part, though, wasn't the shame either. It wasn't the pain, it wasn't the shame. The worst part about the cross, as we said this morning, was the curse of God. He led a spotless, sinless life. He abhorred sin with all his being. He hated it, utterly hated it, and never committed a single sin his whole life in thought or deed or motive. But on the cross, he took upon himself all of the guilt of all sin, the very thing that he despised the most. And he bore in himself the full wrath of God, the equivalent of the suffering in hell of all people, all of humanity, for all of eternity. That's what Jesus suffered. And as he hung on the cross, from below came the jeering, mocking, taunts and rejection of the merciless, vicious crowd. From around him, no doubt, Satan tormented him with every ounce of ability he had to torment, and all of his hosts of demons, every to the farthest degree imaginable, every resource of evil that he had at his disposal. And from above, the worst of all came raining down the infinite, unrestrained fury of the wrath of God, punishment of all sin. All that simultaneously. And from within, the bitter cry, my God, why have you forsaken me?" How great must our guilt have been to require that? It was required of him. Now remember the point of this passage. If he could do all that for you, can you overlook this little offense that your husband has committed against you or your wife or your child? If Christ has done all that for you, can you just give up some of your puny little privileges, and can you put out of your mind that little insulting comment? Can't you just forget it? Can you humble yourself? That's the point. And something this passage doesn't explicitly mention, but that's implied in it, is this. I kept mentioning that this was required of Jesus. Why was it required? There's nothing in this passage that says that it was a substitutionary death, but that becomes obvious from the fact that it was required of him. God commanded him to go through it. For what reason? For the reason of paying for our sin. Paying our debt we owed. That's the only explanation of why God would require that of a perfectly spotless, innocent man. In 2 Corinthians 5:20, it says, "We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God. God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." And in Romans 5:6, it says, "Just at the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly." Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. It goes on to say that it is possible now, as a result of that, to be justified before God, to be reconciled to God because of Christ's blood. Everyone in this room has fallen way short of God's glory, of God's law. Every one of us is guilty. We all have sinned knowingly, repeatedly, extensively, against the most holy, pure, perfect being in existence. We are guilty of cosmic treason, and our doom was sealed. As a result of that, our doom was sure, and our predicament was so dire that the only solution, the only way out, was for God himself to become man, take the penalty upon himself, pay it himself. And Jesus said that if a person believes this, if you believe that, and if you're willing to entrust your life to him, those are the two sides of faith. Faith is the only thing required for salvation, and there's two sides to it. Number one, believe this. And number two, entrust yourself to him. Just entrust your life to him. You do that, and you can be forgiven of everything. Absolutely everything. But he asks a lot. Entrusting your life to him means entrusting him alone with your eternal life. You contribute nothing. You totally rely on him for your salvation. And it also means that you live your life for him instead of for yourself. That's a pretty tall order. It's not something you just tack on to your life to say, "Oh, I think I'll get into religion a little bit." It's not something that you can do on the side. It's something that if you're going to be involved, it's going to require absolutely every ounce of your being. Somebody says it doesn't take much of a man to be a Christian, but it does take all of him. And that's really true. Time after time, people came to Jesus and said, "I'll follow you." And Jesus required 100% commitment. And if they weren't willing to totally give themselves over to following him, he turned them away. Christ turned many people away. And he'll turn us away if we're not willing to completely give our lives to him. So if you live your life for yourself and then get little parts to him, that's not the life of a Christian, and your faith is not real. John 1:4, "In him was life, and that life was the light of men. And the light shines in the darkness, but the darkness was not understood it. There came a man who was sent from God, and his name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning that light, so that through him all men might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. True light that gives light to every man was coming into the world. He was in the world. Though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. He came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God." You want a good symbol for Christmas? The manger's okay, but that's kind of the midpoint of the descent. If we want a symbol of the incarnation of Christ, the humiliation of Christ, the downward emptying of Christ, the best symbol is the cross. That's the bottom. That's where he comes down the lowest. And he did that for our benefit, so that we can know him. And as the song says, "Love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my all." That's what God calls for tonight. Jesus is the light of the world, and he brought light into this world. And because of our sin, our hearts are dark. They're black. No matter how much good is in your life, it doesn't matter, because of sin. If there's any sin in your life, your heart is black. And it can only be lit by the light of a perfect person, Christ. And those who are here, who have given their lives completely to Christ already, every single one of them will tell you, if you ask them, that there's no more wonderful, important thing in their lives than the light that Christ has put in their heart. Nothing. Not their family, not their husband or wife, not their kids even. Nothing is more important. Just ask them, and they'll tell you. But to be out of the darkness spiritually, and to be clean and to be forgiven, is the most important reality a human being could ever experience.